Optimizing the Engineering Team Structure with James Avery.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. Make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for the past episodes and show notes. And once again, the goal of this podcast is to empower you and your teams with the information that you need to move fast and deliver consistent quality using the .NET ecosystem and run your software systems with confidence in Azure. And for those of you running .NET and Azure user groups, I've been doing a lot of online video presentations. And if you run one of those groups, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Our sponsor and my employer, ClearMeasure, is a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. And so if we can help, please get in touch. And if you are a .NET developer and would like a path to become an architect, we're hiring. Just apply on the website, clearmeasure.com. And also, I've just launched another podcast, but a video podcast this time. It's called Architect Tips. And most of the episodes are very short and aimed at showing you something very useful for designing software that's built on the Microsoft platform. And we focus on the Microsoft platform here on this podcast. But when it comes to success stories, we pull them in from everywhere because architectural elements and problem solving and ways to look at software and cloud and everything come from all walks of life. And so we have a very interesting success story to share today. And this is one of those exciting shows. Well, I'm very excited for today's guest, and it is none other than James Avery. And he was a guest on show number 51. And after a year and a half, he's back. James Avery is the founder and CEO of Kevil and a longtime friend and software architect extraordinaire turned business leader. James, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back, Jeffrey.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I didn't realize it had been so long.
Hey, time flies when you're having fun.
That's true.
But last time we talked, and for those listeners who didn't start listening to the Azure DevOps podcast until more recently, go back to show number 51. We talked about the journey of scaling to 3 billion requests per day. But for those who aren't familiar with that podcast or your company, why don't you start us out with the quick story of the company and kind of what you do and why you're doing some interesting architecture stuff and the whole business.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevil is essentially APIs for online advertising. So we work with companies to help them build their own ad platforms. So you look at somebody like Twitter or Facebook, and they've built these really sophisticated ad platforms. We believe that everybody else, you know, all these other companies should be able to build that level of ad platform without having to build everything from scratch. So, you know, the way we kind of look at the world is that advertising can be better. It shouldn't all be owned by Google and Facebook. And there's lots of opportunity, but it's a really big investment. You know, the challenges we have to solve when it comes to scaling and, you know, making these decisions and, you know, 10, 15 milliseconds and reporting, it's a lot of stuff. And so by providing a set of APIs, companies can build on top of those APIs. So in short, if we were in an elevator, you know, it'd be, hey, we're Twilio, but for advertising instead of sending text messages.
So who would be the target customer? Is it anybody that has a decent traffic website?
Yeah, it's usually companies who, you know, it could be e-commerce companies, you know, people like Edmunds, where you're going to research a car and they want to show a really, like, you know, high quality native ad. You know, people like Strava, even where Strava is using us for, you know, when they want to tell you about, you know, an upcoming event, or they want you to upgrade to pro. So there's kind of all these different uses. And we have pretty wide use. I mean, even digital billboards, a lot of times we have a number of those customers that run those using our APIs. And that's really the fun of running an API business, is that we're always surprised by, you know, people that come to us sometimes. You know, there's customers that we know are a good fit, and we're, you know, we actively pursue things like food delivery. But then, you know, somebody comes to us and says, we want to run ads on this billboard, or we want to run them in this jukebox, or, you know, in a car. And we're like, sure, you can do whatever you want. Like, here's the REST endpoint, right?
Nice. So do you guys source the ads themselves? Do they just tap into your network, or what does the customer have to do on their own?
Yeah, no. So we don't sell the ads or source them. What happens is our customers are selling them. Or they're building self-serve interfaces, which is a lot of times what they're doing, right? Like they want their buyers to just come to them, create a campaign, run that ad, and put in their credit card. Okay. And so the customers will go and build that kind of on top of our API.
Yeah. Okay. So very different from Google Ads, where you say, hey, I don't care who puts an ad on my website, just here's right. a spot where stuff can go. Whereas really for you, they know who their customers are, but it's like, okay, how do we charge them the right amount?
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, the Google approach is like, you know, when, you know, back in the day with our blogs and things like that, right? It's like, yeah, a lot of times you would just do that. But then, you know, if you have a really good audience, if you have, you know, a really certain aesthetic and you don't want to, you know, have a kind of crappy banner ad, you know, on your site, like you're going to want to sell it direct. You're going to want to be really careful about advertisers you take on and things like that.
Yeah, you mentioned blogs. There's probably a lot of people who don't even remember the tech blog era, but Twitter or microblogging kind of killed the long form blogging, where we all had our own websites. Do you think that's kind of come back now that microblogging is like not?
I don't know. I do miss it though. I mean, that's kind of how I guess we met through the conference circuit. But, you know, back in the blog era, like, and how this all started was I ran, you know, a small ad network for kind of .NET developers, the Lounge, which you were a part of, and guys like Rob Connery and Phil Hack and Scott yeah. Hanselman. And yeah, it was, everybody was writing blog posts and linking to each other. And, you know, was it not postbacks? Was it?
Yeah.
Pingbacks.
Pingbacks.
trackbacks, like back before they were filled with spam. Yeah, it was a really interesting time. But yeah, it does feel like Twitter and now even too, things like Medium or Substack, you know, people are like, I'm going to build a newsletter instead of writing a blog.
Right.
You know, it's definitely, you know, it's like it makes us sound old. Now we're reminiscing about the middle 2000s. Right.
Well, it gives a good perspective, just big aside, whereas with all the uproar with censorship going on, it makes us realize or even question, what is the architectural differences? And I reflect and think, well, okay, an email address, there's a whole protocol around email yeah. where you say, you know what, even if it's provided by Yahoo, the agreement is that I own my email. And blog, I own my blog. And architecturally, I'm running the DNS, but when you use a social media platform, regardless of which one it is, it almost doesn't matter which one it is, you're using a service and you don't actually own anything. There's no protocol.
Right.
And it's just fundamentally different.
Yeah, it's really, it is fascinating because I think when you know, with all the talks about censorship and things like that, you know, nobody was turning off people's DNS providers.
Right.
Right. Like nothing was stopping. Anybody who gets kicked off Twitter could set up a, you know, text file and serve it from a server, right? Like, you know, when you get into like AWS cutting somebody off, like, oh, you know, that would be rough, right? Like if, you know, most people are on a given cloud, if it got cut off, you'd yep. have a hard time. But at the end of the day, like no individual is being muzzled because right. there's plenty of ways on the internet to put up whatever you want and keep it hosted.
Right, right.
With no censorship.
If that wasn't true, then, you know, WikiLeaks would have been taken offline, or some of these, yeah, exactly. Some of these other sites that are
all these things like Pirate Bay and stuff like that have just been totally. Running for decades. And so,
totally.
Yeah. And, you know, we could go off on a tangent on this, but, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of people are looking at how does crypto build a new decentralization of more things, right? Like even when you look at something like DNS, right? Like there's protocols out there people are building to say, how do we decentralize DNS? So it's not really just these handful of big companies running the big, backbone servers or ICANN or whoever it is, right? Like it'd be really interesting. I think they're the potential, people always talk about things like consolidate and then they explode. So it feels like we've been in this like consolidation mode,
right?
Of, it's Twitter and Facebook and a handful of things. Like, are we going to get back to like an explosion mode? Like, right. What's the thing in the next like 10 years? Like, we're all going to go create and be like, oh, I created this and I'm running it on a little drop at DigitalOcean. And it's like, that's all I have to do. And it sinks into everything else, but now we're in like sci-fi territory.
Yeah. Well, two episodes ago, my guest was Charles Flatt, and he provided a analogy for architecture that I'd never heard, but I'm thinking, why wasn't I taught this when I was 18 years old? And he said that developing software systems is not like designing a building or designing a house. It's like designing a city. And the roads and all the different infrastructure are the key things that you're making. You don't know what house is going to go in a certain area. And when we were talking about protocols and DNS, that brought that back because when we have just a software system, a single software system even, and we can use it, great. But who's ever that software system is calls the shots. But when we have a protocol that people in the industry, well, now we're living in a software city where, okay, I can be over here in this part of the city and you can be over there in that part of the city. And nobody says, hey, you must leave that city.
Yeah. Well, it kind of brings back to like the, we all like to call things like dumb pipes. Like there's a reason for that, right? Like there's a plumbing system in New York that was built hundreds of years ago that a brand new skyscraper hooks up to the same fundamental plumbing architecture that the house from the 1600s is hooked up to, or 1700s is hooked up to. And so it's an interesting way to think about architecture. And also the other thing I think is funny to point out there is, they're doing these new subways in New York, right? And everybody's pissed because it's costing them like $1 billion to go like a mile or something like that, or some $1 billion. But as architects or developers, we understand why, because you're trying to build a new pipe in a 200-year-old software system versus if you look in places in China where it's a subway and a new city being built from scratch, that's some good greenfield subway development, right? You just slap that thing in there and you're happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And people in New York, they kind of frown on buildings and sinkholes collapsing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'd like, just like we frown on like taking down systems that we didn't intend to with our refactoring or, re-architecture.
Right. Well, that was a fun, that's a fun little aside.
Well, we can go down this analogy for hours.
Oh, totally. Totally. Now you've done some really interesting things with Kevel, but for people not familiar, can you give a quick overview of the technology stack that's under the covers?
Yeah, absolutely. So we built, there's a lot of different tech involved, but the kind of base of it all is AWS. Like we're pretty heavy AWS users. We run out of, I think, 5 regions right now. And that's because we have customers all over the world. Latency is really important. We're pretty heavy users of both Clojure and Node. And so a lot of the delivery systems are built in Node. A lot of the kind of management and backend services are all built in Clojure. But yeah, like you mentioned, we're doing billions and billions a day of requests, and each one of those requests has to happen, pretty quickly, like anywhere from 30 to 100 milliseconds. And in that time, we have to evaluate potentially thousands of potential campaigns or ads that could be targeted, have to include different levels of targeting, geo-targeting and keywords and all this really kind of complex stuff, like in a really, really quick way with like 0% downtime. Because for us, if it's down, then it's costing people, actual money.
Right. All right. So you're all in AWS, how do you reason around regions or disaster recovery or those topics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two things there is that one, different systems have different levels of availability, right? So like different, like with delivery, when we think about people making calls for ads, which is really tied to their revenue, that's the system that's in the most regions and that has the easiest kind of failover between regions and really has kind of a share nothing architecture. You know, one of our things has always been every engine, which is what we call one of these servers, is an island. And so, it's like that, I might've told this story last time, but the myth about the server that gets like drywalled in and just keeps running for like mm-hmm. decades, yep. like that's the goal, is that they should really just be able to run without external requirements. And then of course you're still subject to AWS. If AWS region decides to go down, then we use DNS and things like latency-based routing to be able to route around any regions that are down.
And how often does that happen where you have a hiccup and if you hadn't designed for something, you would have had a disruption in service?
You know, it's funny. Like we've been using AWS. I was looking back at it. Like I think I signed up for AWS in 2008 or 9. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was somewhere around there, like maybe 2009. And back then it was a lot less reliable. You're more likely to have issues. You're more likely to have all of US East go down and things like that. Lately, it's pretty reliable. I mean, I think we've had a couple, I remember there was a decent size kind of EFS outage, a year or so ago. But it was only one region. So for the most part, it's not happening very often anymore with Amazon.
Yeah.
A big part of that, right, is that we've built internally, it's pretty optimized to where we have, a lot of engines behind load balancers. They don't rely on single backend services. Like it's all been built so we should never cause it to have an issue. If it's an issue, it's usually coming from something like Amazon, which has really been pretty infrequent, especially in the non-US East regions. Like I think US East is there in New York mm-hmm. from the standpoint of how hard it is to make changes there and update it. So it seems to be where most issues happen out of US East versus like Singapore or Frankfurt or any of those places.
Gotcha. And how many running processes make this whole system work?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it's thousands. I don't know. Well, I mean, if we're actually talking about like CPU processes, right? Like, or if you're talking about like services.
Yeah, unique applications, unique services. I mean, yeah, you may have 100 of a certain type running to balance the load, but how many unique little applications are running around?
Yeah, it really depends on, if we look at delivery is pretty optimized to be, it's a single process that you're calling and getting back your answer. And that's just by nature of us trying to get latency as low as possible. And not, we don't want to, like a micro architecture kind of microservices thing can be great, but it also just adds lots of hops in between. And every hop has some amount of millisecond latency or, sub millisecond latency that adds up. So when you make a request to us to get a response back, it's all pretty self-contained in one process that's trying to get that response done as quickly as possible.
Okay. And how many engineers roughly?
Yeah. We talked about a little bit before the show, but we recently raised an A round and started scaling up a lot. So we're at about, I want to say it's 15 to 20 engineers at this point. We have a couple open job recs too. So if anybody out there is looking.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
And you have a unique take on how to structure a software engineering organization and how to figure out, okay, how many teams do I need and how to align them? What's your philosophy there?
Yeah, so we actually just made a change recently that I think is a little bit different than how a lot of people do it. And it's fundamentally hard, right? Like when you have a team of five or six engineers, it's pretty easy to coordinate with everybody to get things done. You know, you probably have one PM or a project manager. But as we started to grow, we found that that gets harder and harder if you keep the teams aligned with kind of their horizontal slice of the organization, right? So and previously, we'd have a team who was focused on just delivery, which is, you know, the serving of ads or requests. And then we'd have a team that was focused on the kind of management API and UI. We have a team who's focused on reporting and kind of the backend data. And we found that to get one small thing done, right? Like you want to get a field added to the UI that goes back into the ad system that then gets reported on. You now basically are including, you know, every PM across the whole org. You know, it's like all three PMs have to work together. All the lead engineers and possibly other engineers from the teams have to work together to do something that, you know, if you were just starting a new system would take you a couple of days, right? Like fairly simple change. And so the way we decided to approach it was to rethink it and say, what if we aligned product and engineering teams based on business objectives? So I'm a big fan of this book called Inspired by Marty Kagan, where he talks about really empowering product managers and really giving them business goals versus giving them tasks, right? Like when you, like product management is probably the, you know, where, you know, two product management jobs could be very, very different from each other, depending on which company, you know, you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And what we wanted to work towards was we didn't want product managers to be kind of being given tasks from on high, right? Where I'm saying, okay, these are the two things I want to get done this quarter, or these are the five things I want to get done this month. That instead, product managers got to be really the kind of mini CEO role over a certain piece of the system. But that's really hard, right? If you say, well, you're the product CEO of the UI, and you're the product CEO of reporting, and you're the product CEO of delivery, well, they're not really CEOs now, right? Because they all have to work with each other to get anything done. So what we did was we realigned it around a handful of business objectives, which one is, you know, keeping our customers, you know, delighting our customers. So it was kind of called the customer delight group, right? And so that PM can work hand in hand with customer success, with our account managers, talk to our current customers. How do we make sure our current customers are being as successful as they can on the platform? So, you know, it could be bug fixes, it could be improvements to the platform, it could be, you know, those things that maybe would never get prioritized otherwise, but it's really important to customers. And now that PM has one focus, which is current customers, you know, be delighted, stick around, keep paying us, right? Mm-hmm. And then we can have another PM and we can focus them on developers. And we can say, okay, so we really want, you know, we're an API platform. We really want developers to have an amazing experience using our tool. And so he is fully focused on talking to developers that are on our platform. It could be developers that are prospects that are thinking about using us. It could be developers that are currently using it. You know, they've been building things like SDKs and troubleshooting tools. And, you know, and then they'll hear, you know, oh, the API has this field you have to set that's really annoying because it's required, but then it's not always needed. And so then they can go in and they then go make that change to the API. It's not a matter of like putting in a ticket and trying to get it prioritized somewhere else. Like they're empowered to make those changes. And then we have another team that's focused on new revenue, right? So that product manager, we say, you're going to work with sales, you're going to work with solution architecture, and you're going to figure out, you know, what are the things we need to be building to close more deals, right? And it could be an immediate need, like, you know, we could sign this huge customer, but we're missing this security checkbox feature, you know, or it could be, you know, oh, if we built X, I think it would give us access to this whole new market. But the challenge with that is that it makes a ton of sense from a product management standpoint, but it's a lot harder from an engineering standpoint because now you have a team of engineers where they either have to be totally full stack, right, and can do everything, or that team has to kind of organize and work together to figure out how to get work done. But if you keep the team small, the belief is that, you know, if you I've always felt like when I was an engineer, if you're on a team of like three or four engineers, like you would just figure it out. Right? Like it wasn't like, oh, you're only UI and you only are this thing. It'd be like, well, look guys, like we have this stuff to do this week and I can get this UI stuff done in like 3 days. Let me go do that. And the other guy's like, well, like I don't really know this system really well. And the third person's like, well, hey, I'll pair with you and we'll knock it out this week. Right? Like in letting them adapt and figure out what works and really like work together as a small cohesive team. Like every time I was on a team, it's like once you were at 3 to 4 people was like optimal speed. And then they'd say, oh, we want to go faster. So they'd add 4 more people to your team. And then suddenly you're like 8 people and you have a project manager doling out cards. And it's like all this organization overhead.
Yeah. Yeah. The spirit of the self-organizing team.
Yeah. But
at some point it's hard or less practical to self-organize.
Yeah, and I think we've found a way to try to make it work. We just made this change a couple months ago, so maybe another year I'll come back and give you an update on how it's going. So far it's been encouraging. But then the other piece that I didn't mention was the challenge with that kind of team structure though is who builds that new subway under New York. Right? Like who does that? So we have a separate team that doesn't have a PM that reports up to our CTO or our VP of engineering. And they're focused on the core platform and making sure that, hey, this is going to continue to scale and that it's going to have the uptime and the reliability we need. And so they can be both mentors to the rest of the team because they're, you know, more senior experienced engineers, but they can also work on those things that a PM never wants to prioritize. Right? Like, oh, we want to switch out, you know, technology X for technology Y because it'll do this. You know, that's not always tied directly to more revenue or customer delight. It's kind of tied to overall health of the platform.
Right. And yeah, these success stories are really interesting because there's no textbook that can cover all different scenarios. And especially in a high scale environment or an environment where you can't go down. Would be very bad for your customers if you had downtime or outage and the API started throwing errors. But what's been the approach to test at the various levels when you know, okay, we need to make sure that this API goes to this scale, or if something happens, we don't get the disruption. How do you craft those automated test cases so that they can actually have any chance of proving that?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And over the years, we've taken a couple different approaches to it. First is like there's the test for like correctness, right? And what we do there is actually kind of be able to replay traffic is the key part, right? It's been able to say like, well, I'm going to simulate all the traffic from yesterday or from 2 weeks ago on this new system and kind of pre-prod and make sure that the correctness is still there. That what we're expecting to happen will happen. And so that's the kind of the number one that is, you know, replaying that traffic. That helps some with scalability, but the thing is that things are always changing, right? You know, like you can assume that from a correctness standpoint, what happened last week is a pretty good proxy of what will happen the next week. But when it comes to a live traffic, you know, everything is changing, right? Like maybe there's a game on that causes the site to go crazy or there's a different types of ads that have been loaded. And so one of the things we've always done is, you know, we don't, you know, I think in a lot of systems, especially like enterprise systems, right, you can kind of do the Indiana Jones approach to deployment, right? Of just like, whew, swap it real quick, right? Just swap the statue on there real quick and like everything's going to be fine. You know, because we run so many of these engines, we've always taken this kind of delayed or, you know, kind of staged rollout. And so, you know, we do things like canaries is what we'll call them, right? Where you say, we're going to move one of the, you know, 20 engines in this cluster to the new system. And then we'll evaluate how it's performing versus the old ones. And so to do that, you have to make sure like APIs are all compatible. Everything's always backwards compatible. There's no, you know, there can be no, you know, switching of the statue in the temple. You know, we have to make sure those things are all backwards compatible, but that way we can really put something out there. We can measure it. We can look at revenue. We can look at everything and make sure that it's, you know, behavior we expect. you know, that it's not dramatically slower, right? Like that's what happens a lot when you're in, you know, if somebody makes a change and they didn't think about what could happen, you know, you want to be able to catch that really quickly. And so by doing it that way, you know, replacing one engine in a large cluster out of, you know, multiple clusters, you can really kind of just trial by fire and see what happens.
Okay. Well, that brings a question about the deployment pipeline structure. So you've got multiple services to deploy, but each of those is deployed to many instances. So, you know, all the books and the texts for putting together a DevOps deployment pipeline show, okay, you're going to, you know, do something with your data storage. You're going to do something with the process, but you've got on top of that, hundreds of running instances of that one particular service that just got modified. Are there any things that y'all figured out that just wasn't totally obvious when you put it in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty common practice now in kind of these high scalability environments, which is that we never update anything in place, right? Like, you know, you have a ASG, you have a group of engines. If you want to replace it, you actually are rebuilding the AMI that has that software, and you're launching new versions, right? So there's no like because you know, upgrading in place is always just has room for error compared to bringing up a new server with the latest code on it
and letting the other one die.
Letting the other one die off, right? Like that's the approach we've taken, and we've done a mix of, I know some systems we've been trying to move to cloud formation for most things, but we also have some custom stuff that we wrote before. We kind of wrote our own mini chef like kind of thing that we used for a while, but now CloudFormation's kind of caught up and is doing better.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Now you have such a massive amount of data. You do tons and tons of indexing. How much is just in memory versus how much is storage providers are you using?
Yeah, so there's a couple things here, because there's the data that comes in about how ads are performing, right? Like did we show it? Did somebody click on it? Things like that. That's all pretty standard in that we get all that data and we ship it off to Redshift, we run it through Hadoop kind of things and stuff like that to get it in the structure that we want, like a data warehouse. The bigger challenge is always how many campaigns are you going to evaluate on a given request? And so this is where, you know, it can't be, you know, actually, if we go way back, right, when I first started this writing code for the lounge, it's like, well, I ran a select against a table in SQL Server, right? Like that seemed very reasonable for the, 10,000 requests a month we were doing. Obviously, that's not going to scale unless you want to spend, $1 billion on SQL Server. So then it graduated where you start to think, okay, like it all has to be in memory. And so it all has to be in memory in some way or another. And so, you know, we use, historically, we've used things like Redis, also like caches in each process, right? Like the things that are being used frequently, we want to cache in process so you don't even have the slowness of hitting Redis. But recently, some of the work we've been doing is building our own kind of custom in-memory indexing so that we can do this even faster. And so that's when you really get to the scale of saying, I want to evaluate millions of ads to see what the right fit is. That's when you really, like, it kind of breaks any current off-the-shelf technology, and you have to figure out how to build in-memory indexes to really make this as fast as it could be.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like math can guide you here. If there was a data storage component that had, you know, even if you could do 3 million requests a day storage, or and it had a return time of some small amount, but the latency added of just hopping on the network and then off to anything would immediately, sounds like, disqualify that as an option. And that's why he said, no, we got to get it in memory.
Yeah, you know, well, we could run it, like you can run things, like with Redis, we often run Redis on the, like on the exact engine, right? Because it goes back to the every engine is an island kind of thing, right?
On the server, on the operating system. So you're still hopping out of process, but you stay on the same box.
Still hopping out of process, but then the cost really is, right? Like is a lot of times it's the serialization is what gets you more so than than network latency.
Okay.
Right. Cause you can make a call. Network latency is fine, but let's say, you know, indexes are great, but indexes don't get you all the way there when you have a lot of custom logic. You know, maybe you're saying, well, I only want to target people in this certain area at this time zone. Like those things you can query for. But then you might say, oh, I actually have some custom logic written that says, well, I only want to target people if they recently searched for a Toyota Corolla and things like this. Like you can't index everything, right? Like otherwise it's not an index. You're back to doing a table scan, right? And so if you have to pull back, you know, n number of these potential candidates or ads, that serialization cost and cross network cost actually becomes more so than like the actual search latency.
Awesome.
So the more we can do in memory, the better we're always off.
All right. Well, we've gone a little bit long, but this is awesome. Great to update with you, James, and just good success stories. I love having DevOps and cloud success stories on here. Yeah, we're the Azure DevOps podcast, but when it comes to a success story, it's all about architecture and just learning all these different scenarios, because so many of the decision points and the architectural elements are transferable across a large number of technology options. But anything you want to close on, James?
No, I mean, I think maybe when I come back in a year, we've talked about exploring multi-cloud and how to run in Azure as well. So maybe we'll have an update on that in a year. We'll see.
The harbinger. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and spending some time with me.
Yeah, thank you.
And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.